Okay, back on the Arborwood appeal, file number 23-00375, 1:15 p.m. on November 15th. We are still on the applicant's the appellant's cross-examination of applicant's witness, Ms. Bartlett. So, Mr. Telligent, go ahead. Oh, Mr. Telligent, you're muted.
Sorry about that. Good afternoon. Hello again, Ms. Bartlett. We are looking again at Exhibit F-18, your Supplemental Critical Areas Report. And I want to begin this time with your description of Wetland P2. And you say here on page 11 of this exhibit that the United States Department of Agricultural Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, identifies that the mapped soil type in this area is Kapausen gravelly ashy loam. Can you describe what that is?
I can't describe it, just mapped it out.
Can you tell me about the properties of it?
I can't. I'm not a soil scientist. Just map the soils that are out there.
Okay. And then it says here, this soil description is generally consistent with the soils observed throughout the site as noted in the reference geotechnical reports and fill specification letter. If you can't describe the properties of the Kapausen gravelly ashy loam, how did you determine that they were generally consistent with the soils observed throughout the site as noted in those reports?
I'm basing it on the geotech's information.
So they said that what they found was consistent with a Kapausen soil type?
That's what I understood, yes.
Okay. Do you remember, and you say here throughout the site, do you know, is it just Wetland P2 that's a Kapausen soil type, or is it the area around Wetland P2 that's also a Kapausen soil type?
It's not just around the wetland. It's, I can't remember, but I believe it's bigger than just around the Wetland P2.
So it's sort of throughout the whole construction area.
I don't recall from the map. I don't recall the mapping exactly.
Okay. And it says here, you had a footnote that talks about, it says this soil is moderately well drained and the hydro class is B. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes.
And then you have a definition down here of group B soils having various properties. A moderate infiltration rate when thoroughly wet, you know, consists chiefly of moderately deep or deep, moderately well-drained or well-drained soils and moderately fine texture. Why did you include that information in your report?
I believe it was from the NRCS information, and I believe I added it just to show that the infiltration ability.
Okay. And it says these soils have a moderate rate of water transmission. Can you tell me what that means?
Just wrote it down. Sorry, I don't know what that means.
That's fine.
Yeah, I don't really know.
Okay. So that will have a, but whatever it means, you got this information from a credible source.
Yeah, I believe it's from the NRCS definitions. I don't recall, but yeah.
Okay. Do you know, or did you ask Ms. Decker, anybody at Terra Associates, if the fill material that will be placed in the buffers, will it also have a moderate rate of water transmission?
I don't recall asking that, no.
Okay, all right. And then if you go down to the next page, you start talking about fill in the Wetland P2 buffer.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Brian, Mr. Telligent, I don't think your screen is sharing.
Thank you. I am so sorry. Thank you for pointing that out to me. Sorry, we were just discussing page 8 You seem like you were following along just fine, though, Ms. Bartlett.
If I wrote it, then I wrote it.
Right. So we were just talking about page 8 and referencing the Kapausen gravelly ashy loam throughout the site, and then the description and the footnote about these having a moderate rate of water transmission. And then on the next page, you begin talking about the fill in the wetland P2 buffer. And you have this sentence that says, the fill material will grade gradually into the retained forested buffer and undisturbed soil conditions, which will hydrologically connect the groundwater and further facilitate pollutant uptake. What did you mean when you wrote that this will hydrologically connect the groundwater?
It will, I'm not sure. I believe it was the fill at the very bottom of the slope, which will be the 90% compaction, that it will infiltrate into there and then connect with the rest of the groundwater in the undisturbed buffer.
So earlier when, I guess, the idea that, as I understand it, as you just described it, is sort of the water will be coming down, and when it gets to the sort of the portion of the buffer or the portion of the fill within the buffer, that will meet the Terra associate specifications, and so it will sort of filter through that material?
I believe that's what I'm saying, yes.
Okay, and how will that hydrologically connect the groundwater?
Well, it'll percolate down into that soil and get into the groundwater in the soil below.
Mm-hmm. Because earlier when you were talking with Ms. Keyes, you were looking at exhibit B11, and she was noting to you that the definition of a slope wetland is it being fed by groundwater, right?
Correct.
And then you were telling me just a little bit ago that your understanding is that, you know, this is fed by groundwater, which means it's being fed by sort of deeper groundwater that would be underneath the fill material.
That's correct, yes.
And so is this using groundwater in the same sense? Your point is that it will be going down into the deep groundwater, and that's being facilitated by the fill?
Well, the fill specification is intended to allow that water to go down into the soil, the 90% compacted soil, and go down into the deeper ground. I don't know how deep it'll go groundwater wise. I just know that it's going to, my take on it is that it's going to allow percolation down into the soil below.
Allow percolation. Do you know or is it your understanding then that the fill material itself, water will be able to percolate through that just as easily as it can percolate through the ground right now?
That's what I understand, yes.
Okay. If that turned out not to be true, would you want to do a new supplemental critical areas report?
Probably not.
Why is that?
Because I feel like this is what will work for that area.
Okay. What if you found out that in fact, a major source of hydrological input to the wetland is through shallow subsurface flow that's going to be blocked by this road. Would you want to redo your critical areas report to evaluate that, say, under 225D?
Only if it's shown that it's not deeper than the fill, in only that instance, but not in the way it's proposed now.
Okay. And when you say not the way it's proposed now, what are you referring to?
Way that we have it proposed right now.
I know, but right now. Right. But I guess I'm wondering what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that if the road prism had to change and they had to dig deeper, which I know they can't, then perhaps I would have to take a look at that, yes.
If they had to dig deeper.
Right. If they had it, I mean, I still feel that the water is flowing underneath the road, well under the road. And then that if the road prism changed at all, like I said, if they had to do some different grading and that kind of thing, then I would have to look at it, but I wouldn't look at it again in the current condition and proposal.
So Mr. Charmbroy testified earlier that they probably wouldn't have to dig down more than a foot to lay that road. Is that your understanding too?
Yes, it is.
So if they had to dig down more than a foot, you would probably want to do a new critical areas report?
I would say it'd have to be a deep, more than a foot, like several feet at least.
At least. So what are you basing that on? Your understanding that
just like if they go down another foot, I don't think that it's going to block the water. But if you had to go down deeper than that,
okay,
you know, more than that.
And how
but
do you
I don't know
that
depth. I just assume. I don't know.
You don't know. No. Okay. You just have a sort of a feeling that that water is probably deeper than several feet.
That's kind of, yes. I don't know how deep, but yeah.
Okay. And you heard Mr. Wright's testimony?
Yes.
So he was going through some of the impacts that Dr. Cook had talked about. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Keyes ran through some of his suggestions with you. He had on the issue of, or on the change of increased slope, right? Mm-hmm. And remember at the beginning of your supplemental critical areas report, you had these six factors that affect water quality, habitat, and the hydrogeologic functions.
Mm-hmm.
And you had slope. For increased slope, Mr. Wright testified that a mitigation measure would be placing logs across the slope. Is that recommended in your mitigation plan?
It is not in my mitigation plan currently, no.
Not currently. Are you
well,
planning
in
to...
In the current... I don't know. I... It can be added. It's just not there now.
Uh-huh. Why not?
Because the amount of impact of fill and the vegetation along with the soil, the topsoil and the mulch, I feel like that was sufficient to slow the flow of water.
Okay. On the issue of removing the upper soil horizons, Mr. Wright testified that 12 to 18 inches of additional topsoil is generally acceptable for planting and should be from material stockpiled from the site. Is that something you agree with?
Yes.
Okay. And so the topsoil that will be placed on top of these slopes, that will be from material stockpiled on site?
Correct.
And how much topsoil does your mitigation plan call for?
I think I just called for 4 to 6 inches.
So I just told you Mr. Wright testified that 12 to 18 inches is generally acceptable, and you said you agreed. So why are you only calling for 4 to 6?
Because that's what I normally do, and that's what's in the report right now.
Okay. Why not 12 to 18 if that's what's generally accepted?
I think that it's generally accepted, but there are, you know, differing views between wetland biologists, and I just went with what I normally do.
Okay. For loss of soil permeability within the buffer, and Mr. Wright noted this specifically in relation to losses to soil permeability resulting from driving large vehicles over the existing soils. Mr. Wright suggested a mitigation measure which he called scarification or scarification. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
What is that?
That is to take a piece of machinery and drive over the slope to make it so it's not perfectly smooth.
And is that something you're recommending?
I didn't include it in my mitigation report, but generally that's what happens anyway.
So this is another thing that people sort of understand and know, but don't need to include in their reports?
Well, I didn't think it was pertinent to this report, but I mean, it. When you drive over something, when they're grading the slope, they're going to create the, you know, they're going to scarify it. So that would be sufficient for mm-hmm. our purposes.
Yeah, and he had noted this specifically in relation to losses to soil permeability resulting from driving large vehicles over the existing soils. Is that consistent with your understanding that driving large vehicles over the consisting soils will result in a loss of soil permeability?
It could, yes.
Okay. Mr. Wright also talked about a project, I believe I have written down Snoqualmie Ridge. He had described a project which he had likened to this one and said it was similar, where you had a road being built sort of uphill, but relatively adjacent to, I take it, to a downslope wetland. Did you hear his testimony on that?
I did.
And he had said that in that project, they had identified certain performance standards relating to hydrology and then had a monitoring program afterward to monitor the wetland to make sure there weren't any impacts. Are you recommending something similar here?
That is not included in my mitigation report, no.
Why not?
Because I don't feel like the wetland is going to be impacted hydrologically from this project.
Okay. And earlier you had said, you know, for mitigation plans, creating performance standards for hydrology and assessing, you know, how hydrology will be provided, that's something that people in your profession generally know you don't have to do when impacting a buffer, correct?
That's correct, yes.
So why did they do it in that case?
I really don't know. I don't have any knowledge of that project, just from what he said. So I don't know.
Okay. I'm going to go down to now I'd like to begin talking about step away from, you know, wetland P2 and go to the bridge crossings. I'm going to start with this one down here that crosses wetland C6 in the buffer. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. And then there is another one up north, if I can find that, up here, which crosses wetland Z4 in the wetland buffer, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm going to, sorry, for the scrolling. On page 19 of your report, you write, the stream buffers establish the regulated buffers for these crossings because the wetland is contained within a narrow area on both sides of the streams, and the stream buffers are significantly wider than the wetland buffers. Can you explain that to me?
Well, there's a narrow, like it says, there's a narrow band of wetland on both sides of the streams, both streams, but that the stream buffer is the regulated buffer.
And it says that the stream buffers are significantly wider than the required wetland buffer. Can you explain that to me?
I don't remember the buffers for the wetlands. I just remember the buffers for the streams.
What were the buffers for the streams?
150 feet.
Okay, so then if we go back down, let's see here. Actually, this not the right spot. Let's see. Here we go. Well, it says the C6 buffer is 150 feet as well.
Right.
So in that case, the wetland buffer would be the same width of buffer, correct?
Correct.
And for stream buffers are measured from like the ordinary high watermark, I think, or the basically the stream bank.
Correct.
And if the wetland, I mean, the wetland extends further laterally than the stream bank, correct?
Not much.
Not much, but some, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was measuring the stream buffer, you know, so let's go back down to the image. If I was measuring the stream buffer, I would like measure 150 feet out basically from the blue line, right?
Yes.
And if I was measuring the wetland buffer, I would measure basically 150 feet from the green line.
Yes.
Wouldn't that make the wetland buffer on the ground at least wider than the stream buffer?
Just barely, yes.
So why did you write that the stream buffers are significantly wider than the wetland buffers?
It was a typo of some sort. I don't know. I have no explanation for it.
Okay. But, and then it says here, let's see, back on page 19. Is that right? Suddenly I'm in the wrong spot. There we go. It says the stream buffers establish the regulated buffers for these crossings because the wetland is contained within a narrow area on both sides, and the stream buffers are significantly wider than the required wetland buffers. You seem to be saying that the stream buffers are the applicable regulatory buffers because they are significantly wider than the required wetland buffers.
I see that.
But we've just established that that's not true, right? The wetland buffers are in fact wider than the stream buffer, at least for wetland C6.
In some of the locations of wetland C6, yes. But in the crossing, as you will notice, the wetland boundary is barely outside the ordinary high water mark of the stream. So we measured from there and calculated the stream buffers.
Yes, but fair enough. It's just barely outside. But based on the logic in this report, that because the wetland buffers are wider than the stream buffers, therefore the stream buffers and the stream buffer rules apply, wouldn't it actually be more accurate to say that because the wetland buffers are wider, it's the wetland buffer rules that apply?
I don't think so in this case, because the stream is the driving force of this, of the crossings. They're, you know, it's primarily stream. They're identified as riverine wetlands. So that means that they are basically wetland associated with a stream and are hydrologically affected by the stream, and so are really part of the stream system.
So when I look back down at your wetland buffer averaging plan, I note that you don't identify the fill associated with the bridge crossings as a buffer take. Why is that?
Because there's no way to buffer average that or reduce the buffer. So instead, we planted the slopes to create that buffer that's missing.
Well, I mean, why couldn't you, if you're taking away buffer here, say, right? Why couldn't you add buffer over here, just like you did with the other wetlands?
It's not part of the stream buffer crossing criteria,
right?
But it's also because it's allowed in the code as a stream crossing in the stream crossing section, and it doesn't. So that's why we didn't do buffer averaging.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I take it that was your reasoning, but your reasoning was also premised on the fact that it was the stream buffers that applied because the stream buffers are significantly wider, and we just established that's false. So wouldn't we then want to look at the wetland buffer averaging rules?
It still wouldn't meet the buffer averaging rules. Either way.
Well, let's take it one step at a time. You agree that it is false that the stream buffers are significantly wider. And that was the premise for you saying the stream buffers were the applicable buffers. And then you said, well, the stream is still the driving force, but the code doesn't say that, right? The code doesn't say you can get away with only thinking about the stream buffers if they're the driving force. That's not a relevant criterion under the code, right?
No, it's not.
And so we're left with the fact that there is a wetland buffer here, and we have a buffer take. I mean, we certainly have a buffer take where the road is, mm-hmm. right? And
yes.
Then we have fill, but you don't even mark it as a temporary impact. Why don't you do that?
Because the stream crossings are addressed in a separate report called a habitat management plan.
And so is there a rule for wetland? For wetland buffers that says if you do a habitat management plan, you don't have to do buffer averaging?
Well, I don't recall.
Because I mean I would think that, you know, I would think that you might say, well, the bridge crossings are authorized, I mean, by the 225D run ones, right? I mean, that's the same one you're using for the spine road encroaching.
No, it's a stream. It's the stream one that I'm using in this one.
Okay. And I guess I'm just wondering, why are you using the stream one when it's a wetland buffer?
Well, because it's primarily a stream crossing. It's not a wetland crossing. It, and the wetlands will not be impacted. So,
but the wetland buffers will be, right?
Well, the wetland and stream buffers will be, yes.
Yeah. Okay, can you point to any code section that says that just because it's the driving force or it's primarily a stream buffer that we don't have to look at the wetland rules?
I think because we're crossing a stream with a bridge of sorts, a culvert, whatever it is, I don't remember. And we can avoid the impacts to the wetland, then it would be, you would go with the stream buffers.
What about hydrological impacts? Are there going to be hydrological impacts on the wetland buffer here from the fill material?
Potentially, yes.
Why aren't, I mean, are those discussed in your report?
Nope.
Why not?
Because we were just addressing the stream crossing as, you know, spanning all the hydrologic features of that wetland and of that stream and wetland.
Because you were just doing it that way. Okay.
That's the way we do it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the way we do it?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see here. The utility corridor. Page 17. Here it is. So here we're talking about the sewer line corridor, and you say the soil removed from the sewer force main trench will be stockpiled alongside or near the work area for the replacement, for replacement back into the trench. Once a pipe is in place, there will be no change to the soil consistency or texture. Tell me about that. Why will there not be any change to the soil consistency or texture?
Because it'll be the same soil put back in.
But doesn't the soil get like jumbled up? Like, isn't there a soil structure right now from plants and animals and roots and all sorts of stuff? And then when you put it back in, you don't recreate that, right?
Well, that's not possible. But most of that utility line is within a road. So so there will be that soil will be replaced and will be the same as what's there now.
And what kind of road are we talking about?
It's an old logging road.
Okay. I know there was a logging road, an old logging road between wetland L2 and P2. Is it similar to that logging road?
No, it's much more used.
Okay. Do you know anything about the installation of pipes? Do they have to go over like a compacted base?
I have no idea.
Wouldn't that affect the soil texture and composition?
Sure. Yes.
So how come you're saying here that there will be no change to the soil consistency or texture?
Within the above the pipe, it'll all remain the same because the pipe's going to do the same thing as the compacted, the layer below it.
I see.
So it'll be the same that's being put in. It'll be put back in once it's all in.
So you're just talking about the top of the soil.
Well, however many inches or feet is above the pipe. I don't remember how far down the pipe is.
Uh-huh. And you had said to Ms. Keyes that, well, even if there has to be future maintenance along this corridor, which may involve sort of digging this stuff up in the future, that's not considered a permanent impact unless you build a road. Tell me about that.
Well, occasionally utilities require a road to access different features of the utility. And if you have to put a road in to do that, that would be a permanent impact. And it would be mitigated for, but in this case, it's not needed. And so it'll just be like is now. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, but I thought the idea of a permanent, of a temporary impact is the impact that will basically go away over time.
I don't see that as the same. I don't see that as a temporary impact. I see a temporary impact is removing something, putting something in, and replacing what was there before. Because basically what we'll be replacing is vegetation and that will all still, the seed sorts and that and roots will still be in that soil. So it'll replace that. So then you won't be able to see where it was.
You'll be able to see it.
Right.
Right. But if all that could just go away anytime they have to perform maintenance, how can you really call that temporary if it can all just be dug up in the future?
Well, I think the way they have it designed, it's designed to not require, but you never know what's going to happen. It's still a temporary impact. You dig that section up, whatever section you need to replace or repair, then you put that soil back in and plant it again. I mean, it's still a temporary impact.
So a series of temporary impacts can't make it permanent.
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Is that said anywhere in the code?
I don't know. I know they have part of the code has something to do for roads, and so that would have been addressed.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Bartlett. No further questions.
You were muted, Mr. Ulbricht.
Shoot. Yeah. Oh, I was just asking if you had any questions, Mr. Getches.
Oh, I have a few questions. Not too much. Good afternoon, Ms. Bartlett. David Getches, Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office. Sorry you've had to testify for so long today. I'll try and keep it as short as I can.
That's all right.
So let's see. First, I'll show you Exhibit C1. There's one paragraph from this exhibit. Share my screen. Can you see that?
I could see your, Explorer.
All right, this is a declaration of a former DCD employee named David Greetham.
Mr. Getches, I don't mean to interrupt, but we're looking at a OneDrive folder with the declarations listed and not the actual declaration.
Okay, let's try this. But now.
There we
go. Got it.
Now you can see it.
Okay. Technical difficulties. So it looks like between in 1990 and 2016, he was a planner for DCD. And I just want to look at paragraph 7 here, where it says, get this blown up a little bit. We did not require buffer averaging or variances if the proposed road met the requirements of Kitsap County Code 19200-225D 1 through 4, unless it was proposed as a component of the required mitigation plan. And then I want to show you, I think I'll have to stop sharing and reshare. This section of your report, this is F18. Do you recall this section where you were discussing 19200-225D?
Yes.
Okay, and then scrolling down to the part about mitigation, where Mr. Telligen was focusing your attention, where it says, mitigation necessary to allow spine road A and the standard buffer for wetland P2 can be readily accomplished through mitigation sequencing by way of creation of additional buffer. And in interpreting that, you made it sound like you thought that buffer averaging was required if you use 225D, but would you agree with Mr. Greetham's statement that it isn't unless it's been made part of the mitigation plan? Buffer averaging.
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay, so in this case, we've used buffer averaging, but would you agree that there's nothing in? So let's go from here to page to the vested 19200225D. Can you see that now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. And would you agree that there's nothing actually in here that references buffer averaging, describes minimum standards, and then lists them 1, 2, 3, 4, and the fourth is the one regarding mitigation. I guess what I'm getting at is I think people could interpret your testimony before as meaning that you thought that buffer averaging would always have to be a component of 225D, but are you just saying that it was a component here because it was made part of the mitigation plan, and not that it
Yes.
has to necessarily be a component of 22 if you're relying on 225D?
I believe that is what I was thinking as that would be the that buffer averaging would be the mitigation for the road,
Right.
just to
That's
make
what
sure.
it then.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
Okay. So let's see. Let's look at. Let's look at 443. No, not that. Okay, well, let's look at okay, let's look at oh, this is I need to get out of this one and go into the appellant's exhibits. So and then share, go here and share, and then I'll go to 443. This one. Can you see my screen right now, Ms. Bartlett?
I can, yes.
Okay, do you remember there were some questions about this version of the stormwater design that showed a energy dispenser, a gabion, directly discharging at wetland P2?
Yes, I do.
And then do you recall him referring to Mr. Charmbroy and Mr. Moody's testimony where they explained that subsequent versions of the stormwater designs showed the gabion moved much further away from to the north and east, maybe I think it was 85 feet or something to the north and east of wetland P2?
Yes, I do.
And then he still described that as still being either way, still being a direct discharge. So my question for you is, if the gabion wasn't here but was moved much further away, would you still consider that a direct discharge to P2?
I would not.
Okay, just wanted to ask about that. And then while we're on these appellant's exhibits, let's look at. Well, I think I'm going to have to go back here and find it here. This one here. Swales. Do you recall looking at this diagram that Mr. Lubisher drew showing water flowing from east, uphill east, west over to wetland P2? And the
Yes, I
arrow
do.
symbolized the water. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
And and you remember this Hillbend Road, Mr. Rosine saying, well, the reason that Mr. Lubisher believed that the water could just go right past a road and have it not act like a dam is he assumed that the road must have been designed that way so that water would not be obstructed by the road, whether it was surface water or deep water, it would make it past the road and onto P2.
I'm not sure I understand the question entirely.
Okay. Will you remember both Dr.
Yes.
Rosine and Mr. Lubisher testifying that roads are dams?
Yes.
And that one of the reasons why not to build a road here is because it will act like a dam and act like a tourniquet that chokes off all the water to the west, including all the water feeding wetland P2.
Yes.
And so then I asked Mr. Rosine, well, if that's true, if we were to believe that roads are dams and there's a road right here, then should there really be an arrow showing water flowing freely downhill to wetland P2? And I wasn't saying that roads are dams
mm-hmm.
or that the arrow shouldn't be there. I was saying that if we are to believe that roads act like dams, then should there be arrows showing water flowing freely? I don't know. Do you recall any of that testimony?
I do, yes.
Okay. And do you recall when I asked Dr. Rosine about it, he said because he assumed that this road was designed so that it wouldn't obstruct the flow of water, like with culverts or whatever.
Yeah.
He said
I do remember
roads
that,
can
yes.
be designed that way.
Yeah.
And then I asked, well, with these two arrows, if there's actually already multiple roads in between wetland P2, not far away, right here in the Hill Bend area, and roads are dams, then shouldn't we expect wetland P2 to not be doing very well because it's being choked off of all of its water supply uphill and to the east? And again,
yes.
he said, same answer as here, that it was probably designed so that the water could continue to flow on as depicted by the arrows, and
right.
feed and sustain wetland P2.
Mm-hmm.
And then we looked at, let's see if this will work. I think I have to stop share and then reshare. Go to here. Share. Is that not, okay. Let's go out of this, go into this. Is that not sharing? Okay. Let's see if we can. Let's try. Still not sharing. Okay, let me close everything out, please. Give me 1 second. I'll close some extra. Try this one more time. How about now? Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. So do you recognize, I know it looks a little different than in Mr. Lubisher's drawing, but do you recognize what we're looking at here, the Hillbend neighborhood with Hillbend Lane?
Yes.
And you see these paved roads here in addition to Hillbend Road here?
Yes.
And you recall what when P2 was over here?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, did you notice? Have you been to the site?
Yes, I have.
Have you looked at P2?
I have.
Does it look like it's suffering from the fact that there's roads here and not getting any water if this is the source of water to the east?
It looks like it's functioning and acting normally as a wetland.
Okay, let's see if these roads have been here for a while. So this is a 221 image. Let's look back, well, let's start with 10 years, almost 10 years ago. Let's see if they were there in 2015. And you can see there's still roads there. And let's go all the way back almost 20 years ago and see if there's roads there then. They look like dirt roads. Did you mention that if there's vehicles that travel on top of a road, then that can compact, and it's a dirt road that can compact it?
I recall hearing that, yes.
And you agreed that that can happen?
Yes.
Okay, so these, if these were dirt roads, they probably had been compacted by vehicles. I mean,
correct.
Over time, and yet you see, I mean, this looks like it's before it was paved. And yet, as you say today, the wetland looks pretty good.
Yes.
Okay. So I think, let me think if there's anything else I wanted to cover. All right. Sorry about all the technical difficulties. That's all I've got for now.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Getches. I have just a few quick questions, and then we'll go back to Ms. Quees. Get that up here. There we go. All right, Ms. Bartlett, so your the table two of your supplemental report should be showing right now. Now, I just want to get make sure I understand, you know, how you did your buffer averaging here when I review the record. You know, I've dealt with buffer averaging a lot for individual wetlands. This is a little different to see it done like in a collection. And what I'm just trying to figure out is, after you've done your buffer averaging, is each individual wetland still going to have the required buffer area around it, or are you adding buffer area to one wetland where it has more than it needs and then another wetland has less than would be required if it complied with the code? I mean, is it, I just can't tell because this is divided into areas, whether you're saying there's no net loss of buffer area because in total when you subtract and add to each wetland, you know, you get your 1.69, or whether you're also still ensuring that each individual wetland still retains the amount of required buffer.
It, if you look at the table, you can see like wetland L2 is a good example because it's a bigger one and it has those smaller ones next to it. L2 mm-hmm. has a lot of buffer added mm-hmm. that will also protect the other smaller wetlands that are mixed in there a bit. So each wetland should have similar buffer areas around them.
Oh, okay. So it is kind of done at the individual level and then also done in the wetlands overall. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure on that. All right. And then another good thing, which, you know, is I've always been kind of curious about this, is success of wetland mitigation. And you mentioned that your mitigation plans are successful 65% of the time. And when Ms. Quias asked you about the other 35%, you said it depended on whether actions were taken basically to remedy the situation. I mean, do you know why sometimes actions aren't taken? Is it because the monitoring plan doesn't sufficiently provide for corrective action, or is it simply a lack of enforcement on the, you know, on the side of the city or county?
It's not a lack of enforcement. It's a lack of attention from the property owner. They'll sometimes think, you know, they've gotten their permit, they've done their mitigation, now they're done. And so they don't do the monitoring, and they don't do the maintenance, no. And they don't water. So you're going to have a bunch of die off. So that's usually what I see in turn when a plan is not as successful.
So are you saying basically what it boils down to is that if people do what the monitoring plan requires, the success rate would be closer to 100% or pretty close. Is that what it boils down to?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. Yes, that's true.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's all I had. Okay. All right, Ms. Quias, go ahead.
Thank you. Would it be possible to take a 5 to 10 minute break to confer with co-counsel? And I just want to make sure I have correct page numbers for exhibits and everything as well.
Sure. Yeah, let's go to 2:15. We'll come back on then.
Thank you.